The National Broadcasting Company presents the latest news of the war. NBC reporters, on the spot, cover events and report them direct to you. Now, news comes first this morning from London, England.
This is London. Ed Doy speaking. Bad weather kept the Royal Air Force at their bases last night, and only one German raider came over Britain. Reactions to Mr. Churchill's speech in the House of Commons yesterday remain confused. There is general agreement that it was an astute speech from a political point of view. He gave the opposition little to argue about, and the critical portion of the press is holding its fire. The Times editorial is noncommittal, the Financial News editorializes about the diamond market, and the Liberal News Chronicle emphasizes, not without a touch of sarcasm, that all seems to be going well. Only that ardent supporter of the government, the Daily Telegraph, follows up the advantage gained by Mr. Churchill for the Conservative Party in the past few days by one of the most pugnacious editorials in recent history. It applauds the Prime Minister's downright refusal to be hampered by the pernicious clamor of irresponsible armchair military strategists. The destructive critics, the paper continues, are thus given the choice of fighting to demonstrate their weakness or of running away. The forthcoming vote of confidence will show, the paper concludes, what weight of authority and of numbers there is behind the destructive criticism. In the lobbies of Parliament, the Prime Minister's first revelation of information obtained from Deputy Führer Rudolf Hess attracted much interest. It seemed apparent to many in the House that Hitler, after failing to invade Britain last summer, would revert to the World War policy of trying to starve out the British Isles. Hess confirmed this view. But what the critics would like to know is why Mr. Churchill, in possession of Hess's information, told the country emphatically some months ago that the Nazis would probably try to invade by September the 1st. Yesterday, he advanced the date to next spring. Nobody denies the ever-present possibility of invasion, but a war policy based on a miscalculation of more than 1 year cannot be regarded as extremely sound. One interesting point in the King's speeches is also being discussed. It is the King's welcome of the return of Haile Selassie to the throne of Abyssinia. The question is whether this constitutes formal recognition of the emperor's sovereignty. Last week, Professor A. Berrydale Keith, one of the foremost experts on empire constitutional law, said that a telegram or a word to this effect from King George to the emperor would be sufficient to establish the emperor's authority. He could then proceed to throw out the Italians who remain in executive positions in Abyssinia. The position, however, may remain unclarified until translated into action. Military authorities in London today gave out their first detailed surmise as to German losses in Russia. They said that out of 19 panzer divisions which the Germans employed in the attack, 16 were known to have suffered heavily. The 8th Panzer Division, for example, was withdrawn completely from battle early in September and only recently appeared in full strength. It took, therefore, 3 months to reform and re-equip this division. Out of the 180 infantry divisions thrown into the front lines by the Germans, 70 are known to have suffered heavy casualties in killed and wounded. In some cases, one-half to two-thirds of the personnel of the divisions was wiped out. The losses take no account of sickness and disease, which, it was stated, must be rampant among the troops because of weather conditions. Dispatches of British correspondents in New York and Washington hit a pessimistic note about American affairs today. Some editors put scare headlines on the stories, announcing that the Neutrality Act was in danger. There is, however, no comment. People are just holding their breaths because they do not understand what strikes have to do with foreign policy. The BBC did its bit to explain America to the British public. It is using American terminology and translating into English the American English. Last night, the news bulletin spoke of the threatened strike of the Railway Brotherhoods, which the BBC explained were trade unions. I return you now to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
Now look at other capitals as reported here in New York. From Berlin, Hitler's high command says the German troops in the Crimea are attacking the fortifications of Kerch on the eastern section of the peninsula. And Berlin says that several coastal fortifications south of the town have been captured. And from Moscow, the communist newspaper Pravda says the Germans have tried to turn the Russian lines in the Kerch area of the Crimea and strike the Red Army flank, but Pravda claims the attempt was thwarted by Soviet troops. Fighting near Sevastopol was equally unsuccessful for the Germans, according to the paper. It says the enemy bombed the approaches to the city and several times threw tanks into action, but failed to break through Soviet defenses. And now we switch back to Europe and to neutral Bern and Switzerland.
Hello, NBC. This is Charles von Eisenberg. Finland's answer to the United States' peace with Russia note gets front page space here in most of the press today. The Finnish reply, as understood here, is just about what was expected. More than one newspaper compliments the businesslike phrasings of the Finns, and the opinion is that the door has been left open to future negotiations. However, there's no expression of hope that any negotiations to come will be successful. In reality, it's hard to see just how the Finns can pack up now, nor is it conceivable that the Germans would allow them to do so, even if they were willing to come to some kind of an agreement. Germans here just laugh at the suggestion of a separate peace between Finland and Russia. They say there's not the slightest chance of Finland's quitting now, and point out that since the American note was delivered to Finland, Finnish troops in the north have increased their pressure on the Russian lines, chalking up a number of successful actions. Meanwhile, the 6th German assault on the defenses of Moscow is in full swing. Important reinforcements of men and material have been brought up, and in spite of the bad weather and snow, attack after attack has been launched. The Germans don't relish the prospect of a severe Russian winter in the field, and this 6th offensive on the Soviet capital appears to be a desperate bid to capture winter quarters for the Wehrmacht. The Russians claim that German prisoners say that the high command has given divisional commanders the order to take the city at all costs. The hardest fighting is in the Tula section south of Moscow, where the German General Guderian is attacking with 3 powerful tank units. Each of these units is composed of about 400 heavy tanks and tanks equipped with flamethrowers, a weapon which the Germans are said to have found extremely effective. In 2 of the southern sectors, both in the immediate vicinity of Tula, the Soviets admit that the Germans have made progress. That is, they say their troops have given away a few kilometers, but that their main line of defense hasn't been pierced. In Tula itself, the fighting is especially fierce, with hand-to-hand fighting causing heavy casualties on both sides. Altogether, the Russians estimate that in this last offensive, more than 10,000 men, both Russians and Germans, had been killed in the immediate region of the town. About noon yesterday, the Germans hauled up their mobile artillery and began pounding the part of the town held by the Reds. But a later report this morning says that the Russians are still there. Another power attack was started in the Kalinin area north of Moscow in a raging blizzard. But although the Soviet reports are vague, their lines seem to be holding up. They assert that the German losses are so heavy that new reserves had to be thrown in to maintain the violence of the attack. The Reds claim that a big German attack over a wide front in the center was repulsed with heavy losses to the Germans. The Germans say that their shock troops cut through the Russian lines, destroyed bunkers and observation posts, and then retired to their original positions without losses. When the reports of both sides are pieced together, it's evident that the Germans are making a mighty effort to take Moscow, but that the Russians are holding firm. Some observers predict that the new German offensive will fail just like the previous ones. Heavy rains have slowed up action in the Donetsk Basin. The Russians declare that wet, cold nights are causing much suffering among the Allied troops, particularly the Italians. Marshal Timoshenko, taking advantage of this situation, has counterattacked with his fresh Siberian soldiers and has retaken more than 10 miles of territory along a wide front. Polish troops are in the front lines in the Rostov region for the first time. The Russians say they are fighting well and the Germans have been stopped dead. In the Crimea, the German attack on Sebastopol and Kerch is being pushed. The Russians admit that the situation is grave, especially around Kerch. Sebastopol is in a better position, and the Soviets believe that their resistance there will wear down the German offensive. Most of the German strength seems to be directed at Kerch. But even though things look bad for the Russians, their lines are still intact. This is Charles Lanius in Bern. I now return you to NBC in New York.
And that's the latest news of the war. Now let's turn to events at home as reported by Earl Godwin from the NBC newsroom in Washington.
Good morning, folks. A White House attaché, incidentally everyone knows him, loves him here in Washington, William D. Hassett, who has been pinch-hitting for Stephen T. Early, the president's tried and true press secretary, tries to steer America away from the idea that the flare-up in the coal mine situation is a personal showdown between the president and John Lewis, former CIO president and still president of the United Mine Workers Organization. But the rest of Washington sees it the other way. Typical of the anti-labor faction on Capitol Hill is the expression from one strong Southern member who prefers to remain anonymous. He says, "We must lick John Lewis before we can lick Hitler." Well, that's a very strong statement, one which will no doubt arouse resentment among the friends of organized labor, particularly in the ranks of the CIO. But the opponents of organized labor as now conducted and organized are staging a wild revolt against the administration's Neutrality Act amendments until and unless the administration backs an anti-defense strike measure and urges its passage. Solid delegations of Democrats in at least four states are slated to change their minds and vote against the administration's bill to arm the ships and send them into the once prohibited combat zone. That is, it is understood, may not be true, but it's understood this morning that the Democrats, solid Democratic delegations in four states who originally voted to arm the ships, have changed their mind, and as the bill comes back for final passage, will vote against it. That may not occur because the administration is certainly turning on the heat and offering a lot of sugar. But these votes, changed mind votes, happen because they abhor the rising tide of strikes in key defense industries, and it looks like a defeat for the administration. But Sam Rayburn, Speaker of the House, who rarely fails in prediction, who knows the House and the moods of the House and the doings of the House better than anyone else I know, says that bill will pass late today despite all of this ruckus and hip hip hurrah and mind-changing at this moment. Of course, the president saw Sam Rayburn for an hour yesterday and talked with him, and this statement of Sam's may mean that the president is getting ready to make a sweeping statement in condemnation of these rising, widespread, and unnecessary strikes. The railroad strikes, the long-distance operators' threatened strike, the coal strike, and the trucking strike threat, and all the others which rise up in the wake of the mediation board and plague defense are just worrying Congress to death. Tomorrow, the president will have a heart-to-heart, straight-from-the-shoulder talk with three men who run the steel corporations, which own the mines, and also with the three mine union workers' chieftains. Will the president threaten the use of the army, or what? The fact of the matter is that the American public, that is, as represented by its Congress here, is exasperated and no end worried. The government started off with one U.S. housing authority to spread low-cost housing for low-income people wherever cities needed them and would follow the rules. Today, there are a dozen housing agencies here in Washington, and all are stepping on each other's feet and rapidly getting nowhere. That's what Nathan Strauss, U.S. housing administrator, the original administrator, told a congressional committee yesterday, and he's going back at it today. Strauss is one government official who retains the original ideals and views, and he laid about him in no uncertain manner when he charged yesterday that greed and personal jealousies and a queer flirting with private speculators had interfered with the proper development of the housing program. One outstanding boner, he said, was the ousting of a whole apartment house full of tenants, thus adding to the housing shortage in Washington, so that one new housing agency to tell people how to avoid housing shortages could be installed where people were already living. The organizations of housing agencies and the housing lobbies constitute here in Washington the greatest aggregation of red tape I have seen in 25 years, and that's all from Washington at this time.
That's the latest news in Europe and here at home. We've brought you Ed Deuce from London, Charles Lanius from Bern, Switzerland, and Earl Godwin from Washington. This is the National Broadcasting Company.